Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely. Thank you for inviting me down again. Briefly, with regard to the factual background in this matter, July of 2010, Omari Clark had gone to the neighborhood where his mother resides in order to fetch his lady love and their child. Because of circumstances that occurred outside the house, including his burst of anger, which put him in an assaultive mood toward her, other people from the household that she was in came to her rescue, and there was a brief melee, and at which point the defendant, Mr. Clark, was smashed in the back of the head with a chair. Being surrounded and hit in the head, he took flight and ran to his mother's home, ran in, locked the door, pounding on the door outside, armed himself with a knife, waited until the coast was apparently clear, removed himself from the residence, returned to his car nearby, and drove away somewhat uneventfully, or somewhat eventfully, I suppose I should say. Before he drove very far, he realized that his daughter was still in the environment which he had concerns about, and made a very fateful decision in his life, and instead of going back home, he chose to go back to the residence where the original attack had taken place. He parked out front and made a second fateful decision, and that was to arm himself with a kitchen knife as a defensive tool. Soon he walked outside, walked up to where the porch was to the residence, and was confronted by the appearance of the victim in this particular case, who had armed himself with a long object which turned out to be a walking cane, which was seen by Mr. Clark at that time of night, with the lighting conditions being as they were, as a baseball bat. It is rather uncontradicted what happened at that point, in that Mr. Brower, the homeowner, advanced toward his porch and began walking down his porch. Mr. Clark stood there. They were in a confrontational mode. Everything is happening at a very rapid rate. Mr. Brower shows his irritation by taking the object in his hand and smashing it against one of the fixtures of the porch, causing the object to break in some fashion. He then, according to Mr. Clark's perception, began swinging it at Mr. Clark in a downward fashion, which Mr. Clark described as wailing. When I reviewed my brief, I looked at wailing and saw W-H-A-L-I-N-G, and I thought that doesn't look right. So I looked up Urban Dictionary, and I won't even comment what that says it is. Then realized it's really W-A-L-E-I-N-G, so although I was momentarily ignorant in what was put in there, I want to correct that, and it is W-A-L-I-N-G, to apply so as to leave wales or marks on the surface of the skin. At that point, there's an indication that Mr. Clark ducked. Simultaneously, as he believed Mr. Brower was coming from a superior position toward him and swinging this object, which he thought to be a bat, he thrust out one single time, apparently without looking particularly where he was going to locate it, and it proved to be the fatal blow, and the rest is history. At trial, we presented a multifaceted defense and relied upon the statutory scheme of our state, beginning with Title 11-461, which says that in any prosecution, and that would seem to include first-degree murder or murder in the second degree or manslaughter, justification under 464 is a defense. However, in the statutory scheme, there is one limitation, and that is found in 470, which says that if you form a belief, either on inadequate circumstances, fail to get the right information, or have inaccurate information, then you are precluded from using that defense when the element that you are defending against is reckless or criminally negligent.
Well, don't we need to be very specific as to what the limitation is? It's unavailable in a prosecution for an offense for which recklessness or negligence, as the case may be, suffices to establish culpability. Isn't that
correct?
Different?
If you are negligent in forming the belief, which we are not urging that to be the case.
Where is forming the belief phrase in that statute? Did I miss it?
But the defendant is reckless or negligent in having such belief or in acquiring or failing to acquire any knowledge or belief which is material to the justifiability. That's the limitation.
Okay, so this 470A quoted by the state is incomplete. Page 8 of their brief.
478 is with persons for responsibility for another person.
470 little a
470 little a is inaccurately reported in the state's brief. It's glossed over. If the argument was, gee, I made a mistake, I didn't really know, and I shouldn't have been using deadly force, too bad, because you can't use that on a manslaughter. If it is, look, I was perfectly, this is what I believed, and I wasn't negligent or reckless or criminally negligent, 470 doesn't apply. That's the only limitation in acquiring or forming the belief, not in the conduct itself. We then get to the next issue that occurred at trial, and that was the so-called, and I call it so-called, inconsistent defense position, where the trial court ruled that you are not permitted, you have to choose the horse to ride on. And under the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment, a defendant is entitled to present his defenses, and Delaware law clearly permits, even urges, now permits is the word, permits inconsistent defenses to be presented to the trier of fact, and it is for the trier of fact to decide. And then that takes us to the interpretation given by the trial court in terms of real life and the absurdity of the positions that would be advanced. And I use the example because I probably don't have to tell you, the abstract, so I have to bring everything down to the concrete. Helps me articulate. Three brothers are standing next to each other, and there is one attacker standing on a porch who has a bat or some kind of bat. The three brothers have small knives, 2-inch knives. Brother number one perceives that he is going to be either killed or seriously injured by this attacker with the bat. And he says, you're going to kill me? Guess what? I am going to kill you, and deliberately sticks a knife in his heart and kills him. Under the trial court's ruling, he would be entitled to a complete acquittal on the charge of murder in the first degree. Brother number two, he sees the same threat under identical circumstances, but he's not quite as vicious or malicious. And he says, you know what, I'm going to stick you, and I'm not going to really pay attention to where I stick you, and I'm not trying to kill you, understand, but if I do, it's on you, you shouldn't have come near me. He doesn't have a defense under the trial court's ruling, because that would be a manslaughter, reckless state of mind. And brother number three, who I'll call the dummy, he doesn't even think. He's just going to prick him a little bit, sting him, let him remember what it's like. And he just goes and gives a stick out there, criminally negligent, because he didn't consider, I'm close up, I'm in a vital area, maybe that knife is going to kill him. He has no defense at all. So brother number one, who is more malicious, a worse person, a more evil, black-hearted individual person, we could say, he walks. Brothers two and three, different gradations of culpability, they have to pay a penalty. Brother number two, 2 to 25 years. Brother number three, 0 to 8 years. Makes no sense at all, but that's the trial court's interpretation. We take it a step further. Two people commit manslaughter. Person number one, unprovoked, walks over and stabs somebody. Manslaughter, you're guilty. Person number two, he's being attacked. He sticks the person recklessly. You're guilty. So an unprovoked and a provoked attack under the interpretation given to the law give you the same penalty, and we know that makes no sense at all. But yet that strict interpretation of confusing conduct with mental state, which is what I suggest has happened, because the trial court concludes you are using purposeful conduct, which is the act of thrusting, without differentiating between what is my purpose. And I have you note that 464 does not ascribe a state of mind in justification. It permits in the reading of the statute. It's anybody who believes is justified, whether they believe it, as long as they're not reckless in forming the situation, whether as they do the act, they do it intentionally, I want you to die, or I don't care if you die, but I'm not trying to kill you, or dang, never thought of it. 464 covers the ground, and under 461 it is permissible.
Can you give us an example where 470 would preclude
Okay. Somebody comes at you with a wiffle bat. Oh my God, this guy's going to kill me. That's totally unreasonable. Depending upon, and that's just one of the circumstances. If the perception of the threat is recklessly formed as opposed to an honest belief that has some basis, then you say you're not getting the free pass. There has to be some rational explanation for you using deadly force. And it's on you. If you're negligent in forming that belief, or if you're reckless in forming that belief, you don't get to use it under certain circumstances. But once you have that belief honestly unaffected by negligence or other defective state of mind, whether or not you are reckless in how you do it or you're reckless in what you're trying to accomplish, the statutory scheme and common sense suggest that that should be available as a defense, as those cases that are cited in the opening brief suggest and support.
Mr. Hurley, what did you request the trial judge in terms of a ruling or an instruction to the jury, and what did the trial judge therefore erroneously deny?
Okay. I am doing this from memory because I couldn't find my appendix this morning. I believe that I would have asked for, first, the lesser-included offenses that were given, and I would have asked that the defense of self-defense be made applicable to those defenses as well. I don't remember if I said criminally negligent homicide or not. I think I left that one alone and asked for a lesser-included on the two offenses that had a reckless state of mind, murder second degree and manslaughter, and that was denied.
Manslaughter was the conviction, correct?
No, murder second.
Murder second?
Mm-hmm. So clearly it would have been manslaughter as well because the jury didn't have the option. Once that jury found this guy was reckless, they couldn't go on and say, yeah, but you know what? He was under attack. He gets self-defense. They were told, you can't use that. And that's the problem. Had they had that ability, they may have said, you know, he was reckless, but this guy was defending himself because we already found we've excused him on murder in the second degree. Maybe they used it as self-defense. Maybe they just said there wasn't intention. We don't know that. But it's certainly arguable they already found it to be a valid defense, what they were allowed to apply it to, which is incorrect English. So there is certainly a thought, you know what? What if they had had the ability to use that shield of self-defense on murder second degree? Would they have said, even though he's reckless, nonetheless, under the circumstances, he was defending his life, and he was entitled under the law to be reckless at that stage?
Did you request an instruction or suggest alteration to any instruction offered by the state or the trial judge under 470?
No, I did not under 470. There was emails going back and forth, but I don't believe that I asked for any alteration of 470.
I'm looking at your appendix. It has apparently form instructions with handwriting and crossing through. Is that your writing?
I don't know, but that's not what I would do. I can only say it wouldn't be my way to do it that way without commenting on why. With regard to the second argument, I don't have a whole lot to say except it upsets the whole apple cart when we have a transcript that speaks for itself and the state tries to say, oh, well, let's speculate that rather than it being the judge who inadvertently didn't say a word that turned out to be key and critical, we will assume as a matter of law and the fairness and integrity of the trial process that it was the court reporter who dropped the ball rather than a misstatement by a judge, and there's no logical basis for doing that. If we start to do that now, we are in trouble as we rely upon the official certifications of records below. And I note the state had the opportunity, if they so chose, to seek a remand to further investigate the court reporter listening to the recording, if they do these things, whatever the case may be, rather than just simply throwing up in the air, oh, well, obviously it was a mistake made by the court reporter, not by the judge.
Any other portion of the instruction which suggests an intent not to comment on the evidence? In other words, the word that's missing is if. Is that right?
Yes.
Is the if anywhere else in the instruction from which, as a whole, one could correctly infer the state of the law?
That is so glaring that no matter what else is there, when the judge says, the defendant was reckless, therefore there was no justification. Whatever curative, and I don't know the answer to the question specifically, but whatever curative stuff was out there in this whole body of 15 minutes of talk that's given to a jury and all these pages, when you zone in on that, that's like bingo, game's over. And
if it was so glaring, was there an objection?
There was not an objection, and that shows you I don't listen to instructions all the time. That's exactly what happens. I make an assumption, and I admit I don't sit there and listen because I've heard them so often, so I tend to sit there, and let them be said over and over without my paying particular close attention, which I won't do in the future, by the way, but that is something that I have done, characteristically, okay? They're right. I read them. They're going to be recited right, and just assume they will. Thank you.
Well, I'm confused. We have an order, a sentencing order, the fourth day of November 2011, sentencing the defendant for manslaughter. And we have an order of this court referring to Mr. Clark appealing his Superior Court convictions of manslaughter and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. Is that all erroneous?
That means, as I told you, I didn't get to check my appendix today. That's me blowing a call.
Well, the reason I wanted to be clear on that is in trying to sort through what justification defense which you may have been entitled, it struck me that the two possibilities for manslaughter are quite different.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that the trial judge commented on at some point in the record?
I don't recall. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Maria Knoll representing the State of Delaware. First and foremost, the defendant was in fact convicted of manslaughter as well as possession of a deadly weapon during commission of a felony in this case. The options were given for murder first, murder second, and manslaughter, and the jury came back with manslaughter. The facts.
Is it correct there are two bases for manslaughter?
There are two bases for manslaughter, and I believe the two bases were put in the instruction to the jury, Your Honor.
Was there an interrogatory as to which one the conviction was under?
There was not.
So we cannot tell.
That is correct, Your Honor. There is nothing to suggest there was no special verdict sheet. There was just the charge of manslaughter, and the instruction indicated if you find that the state has proved either one of the two prongs of manslaughter, then you should find the defendant guilty of manslaughter.
Do you agree that justification would be a defense to 632-2?
I do not, Your Honor. I couple that basically with reading that second prong along with 470. To the extent that there's any element of recklessness or criminal negligence in the manslaughter charge, which there is, because although it says intent to cause serious physical injury, the person employs means which to a reasonable person in a defendant's situation disregards that he could cause death. So that implies recklessness and or negligence as well. And I believe that 470 precludes then a self-defense instruction.
Well, how about Mr. Hurley's point, which is what I thought this appeal was all about, quite frankly, is there's a distinction between the formulation of I am justified in taking the following action. Whether or not the facts on which you rely to say I'm justified in acting in my own defense,
mm-hmm.
whether you gather those facts carelessly or recklessly is important. It's the second physical act that may appear to be reckless, but that's not what the focus of the defense of justification is all about. It's on the formulation in the mind of whether I would, under these circumstances, be reasonably responding to a threat to my life. Isn't there a distinction between the two?
Well, Your Honor,
recklessly gathering the facts to believe you're justified, because it's subjective belief, not objective belief. And then the act that you, physical act that you engage in, is a different consideration of recklessly.
Well, while I believe that may be a different consideration, Your Honor, I believe that the second prong of manslaughter covers it. The intent to cause the physical injury, whether that be in self-defense or not, but recklessly gathering the facts that that amount of force is necessary, makes you guilty of manslaughter because you have, in fact, committed something where you have recklessly disregarded a known risk. And you are still guilty to a certain extent. Maybe not of murder first, maybe not of murder second, but of manslaughter.
But the whole concept of self-defense / justification is that you believe that your life is threatened by another, and you are justified in using force sufficient to take that other person's life. That's what self-defense is all about. Self-defense isn't turn the other cheek. It's take an action that will result in the possibility of the other person dying, but you do so because you've formulated in your own mind facts that suggest you're justified in acting forcefully in your own defense. Otherwise, you basically emasculate self-defense and say there can't be any self-defense against a charge of manslaughter. That's absurd.
Well, Your Honor, but that doesn't take into consideration 470, which basically says what Your Honor said. The defendant believes the use of force on another person is justified, but the defendant is reckless or negligent in having such belief.
That's the point, in having the belief, not in taking the act.
While I understand.
So the jury is to be able to consider, after being appropriately charged, whether or not the facts available at the time to Mr. Clark suggested that he was reckless or careless in formulating the belief that it was necessary that he act forcefully in a life-threatening way in his own defense. It has nothing to do with what he actually did in stabbing with the knife. That's what 470 is all about. Otherwise, we wouldn't have self-defense to manslaughter at all, because manslaughter, as you correctly point out, one possible basis for guilt of manslaughter is reckless conduct. Mm-hmm. Now, if the reckless action is not one that's justified because you have carefully, not recklessly or carelessly, formed in your mind mm-hmm. the need to defend yourself with life-threatening force, then just because there's a reckless element means you could never have justification for that basis for manslaughter. And that can't be what 470 means. It's not what it says, and it can't be what it means.
Well, Your Honor, under 470, it does says if you're reckless for that belief, then you can employ 470, which is an imperfect self-defense, which would still have you being found guilty.
But doesn't the jury need to be told in an instruction that justification may apply here unless you believe that Mr. Clark recklessly formed in his mind the facts that he believed justified him in exercising life-threatening force on the victim? Unless they understand that's their role, they never have a chance to find justification.
Well,
they can reject it if they find, as 470 suggests, that belief that he had was carelessly or recklessly formed, but only if they're told they have to find that in order to reject justification. Otherwise, he's entitled to a justification charge on that second basis for manslaughter.
Well, Your Honor, well, there's two issues at play here. One, he was given a self-defense instruction as to the murder one, and it was repeated again under the murder two.
Yeah, but we're talking about manslaughter here.
While I understand that,
you're not talking about murder one or murder two. Jury's decided that. That's off the table. The question here is, was he entitled to a justification charge carefully tailored to the second basis for manslaughter? Not the first, but the second. And we unfortunately do not know which basis the jury relied upon, because as Justice Ridgely's question pointed out, there was no special interrogatory asking them to tell us at the end of the day which basis for a manslaughter conviction they relied upon. So we're stuck with the question here. Was it fatal error in this case not to give a justification charge so the jury could sort through whether or not he carelessly or recklessly formulated the belief that he was in a position where he needed to defend himself with life-threatening force?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it was a fatal error, and while I understand that you're saying that 470 is the problem, 470 is saying that justification is unavailable under that situation. But also we have to look at the facts of this case where as to whether a self-defense instruction was even warranted to begin with. And while he got it for murder first out of an abundance of caution, this was not a self-defense case, and he didn't even satisfy either prongs of justification here.
Well, please explain to me how a trial judge can conclude that he's entitled to justification for murder first and murder second on facts that don't justify a self-defense or a justification charge, but not entitled to it for manslaughter.
But the state's argument, Your Honor, is that he wasn't entitled to it at all with respect to either issue, with respect to either charge. The fact that it was given with respect to the murder first doesn't change the facts of this case.
Okay, then explain to us how the facts do not warrant a justification charge as applied to any of the charges he faced.
As to any of the charges he faced?
Yeah.
In this particular case, he started the incident by going to the house to pick up his girlfriend. When she came outside, he started beating on his girlfriend. They came out to assist her and said they were going to call 911. So he went up to the ultimate victim in this case, slapped the phone out of his hand, and pushed him. The sons came out to his assistance, came out to the assistance of the victim, threw a chair at the defendant. Defendant ran to his house. He went into his house where he said on the stand, "I was safe." He then got a knife and came back out. He said that the reason he did that was because this is my mother's block. And this, my Jaguar was outside. That's what he said. He came outside to get his Jaguar. When he came outside, he noticed no one was around. He got in the Jaguar and drove off. At trial, he decided that, oh, now I'm going to say I went back to get my daughter. So he decides to come back to get the daughter with the knife in hand. The victim comes to the front door because his wife is already outside and has already been confronted by the defendant with a knife, asking her who she is, and says, "Get off my property," and slams the cane down. And for that, he gets stabbed in the stomach. The defendant never said, "Where's my daughter?" The defendant never called 911. He left the scene twice. He came back. He was the initial aggressor.
Is this the state's version of the events or the defendant's testimony you're recounting?
I'm relying on three different statements by the defendant, Your Honor, because he gave two statements prior and a third.
Well, you may be able to impeach him, but at trial, is that the version that he gave, what you're telling us?
At the trial, he said, and I took a synopsis of it after I did the digest of it, was that he had dropped his daughter and his girlfriend at that house. He thought that his girlfriend was going to be leaving that house. And when she wasn't leaving that house, he was a little bit angry. So he started texting her. When she did not come back out at 8 o'clock, at 9 o'clock he went over looking for her. They said she wasn't there, so he stood in front of the house waiting for her. Eventually she came outside, and he admitted putting his hands on her. Then the victim came outside and says, "I'm calling 911. He says, "You're not getting into my business." Slaps the phone out of his hand and pushes him and takes a swing at him. That's what he said on the stand. At that point,
the trial judge determined there was enough evidence to give a justification instruction, at least on murder one, right?
Yes, he did. He did, out of abundance of caution. And if you also look at
wait a minute. You say out of an abundance of caution. Is that a quote from the trial judge, or is that your interpretation because you take the position that the facts are insufficient to support a charge of justification? What you've just done is give us an excellent summation to the jury after they're charged on justification about why they should not find that justification applied because the defendant was careless and reckless in his mental formulation that he believed he could use life-threatening force. But that's not the question. The question is, are there sufficient facts in the record that would support a charge of justification? Not whether or not it would be successful at the end of the day, or someone as gifted as you are with at oral argument and summation to the jury could convince the jury to reject justification. The question is a simple one.
Mm-hmm.
Even where the facts are in dispute, are there any facts that would justify instructing this jury on justification on the second basis for manslaughter?
The answer to that, Your Honor, is no. And when I was giving you my rendition, this was from basically the defendant's statement. I wasn't trying to taint the statement. But also, when the lower court judge denied the new trial, what he said in his response to counsel was that he had no business returning back to that house under any scenario. So to ask if whether he, an abundance of caution, that's why I'm saying an abundance of caution. He didn't believe this was a self-defense case either from what I saw.
I just wanted to clear in my mind whether that's your characterization of why the judge gave it, or the judge said, well, flippantly, out of an abundance of caution, although the facts may not justify it, I'm going to instruct the jury on justification for murder one and murder two.
I can tell you from the state's viewpoint, when we did not have an issue with the justification defense as to murder one, it's because we were secure that it didn't apply to this, and it would be an easy argument to make. From the judge's perspective, and I'm taking it based upon what he wrote after the fact, that justification wasn't warranted in this case.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, again, I'm taking the facts according to what Mr. Clark said, which was...
As far as this particular appeal is concerned, does that translate into harmless error? Are you making a harmless error argument?
Well, I would hate to say that, Your Honor, because I don't believe from my reading of error in jury instructions that you can say that this is harmless error, because jury instructions don't generally lend themselves to harmless error. However, what I'm saying in this case is that Mr. Clark himself, in his argument, can't win the argument because a justification defense didn't apply to him. Under the two scenarios, under 464, of where you can't claim justification, he met both. He was the initial aggressor, and he retreated to a place of safety not once but twice.
Okay, well, let's just talk about a scenario hypothetically, then, where justification should be given.
Okay.
And under the second alternative for a manslaughter conviction.
Okay.
Why is justification unavailable in that scenario? Under any set of hypothetical facts.
Okay. And I have thought about this, Your Honor. What I keep coming back to, and I know that it may not be satisfactory to this court, is that basically 470 specifically allows it. Disallows it. We have a statute that says you can't do that if there's any sort of recklessness or criminal negligence in your thought processes.
So, basically, strategically then, if it's an iffy call on justification for manslaughter, never ask for the lesser, basically walk out the door because you'll get it under murder one.
It seems, you know, when you ask for the lesser included, they go to different levels of culpability. If you were reasonable in your belief and your actions, both under murder one, then you can be found not guilty. However, under manslaughter, if you were reasonable in your belief but not your actions, then you are guilty of manslaughter.
Well, to use Mr. Hurley's example with the three brothers, why would the General Assembly ever intend that someone could be justified and walk out the door of the courthouse under murder one, but go to prison for less culpable conduct under murder two simply because of justification not being available? Why would they intend that?
In that particular case, Your Honor, it's because you're getting, the punishment is for the reckless conduct, for the fact that you've killed someone based on your recklessness and in your thought processes. And with respect to Mr. Hurley's example, quite honestly, I didn't necessarily agree with how his rendition of who would get punished in what way. But I thought that it would be different, and each one had some level of culpability. While that is for the jury to decide, if there is recklessness involved, there is a punishment for that. If the court has nothing further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I just have two comments. As I understand the state's argument applied to the real world in Delaware, if somebody comes at you with a knife, not intending to murder you, but just stab you a little bit, is going to kill you, you don't have self-defense. You just run, die, call 911, and wait. And that's basically what it comes down to. And secondly, it is good that I come down here occasionally, because every time that I get thinking how smart and clever I am, I can come down here and get put in my place. I apologize for a very sloppy rendition because I couldn't find an appendix, and I assure you I will never walk in here without an appendix again, because that's not particularly helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.